It's my pleasure to welcome Lisa Go, who is visiting us from CEI Paris in Saclay, France. Lisa is finishing her PhD in, with Valeria Paterino and Martin Kovinger, and she's part of Euclid collaboration as well. And today she's going to tell us about dark energy tomography with low and high reciprocals. Take it away, Lisa.
Okay, so thank you very much, Nayesh, for the introduction. As you were saying, I'm Lisa, and thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to present my work today. Okay, so without further ado, let's begin. So today I'll be talking about couple dark energy models, so lambda CDM model extensions, specifically titled dark energy tomography, and we're going to use low and high redshift probes to try and constrain these models, hence the title. Okay, first I'll start with a bit of context. So I'm sure you're all familiar with the concordance model, the lambda CDM model, which has been widely successful in describing our universe today. However, there are still some very pressing questions that remain. For example, firstly, what exactly is the true nature of dark energy? Is it just some constant that we conveniently put a number to, or could there be some underlying physics to that that we have yet to uncover? And secondly, the two most famous tensions that I'm sure you're all familiar with as well, the Hubble tension and the S8 tension. If, let's say, we ignore systematics, is there any way that we can explain away these tensions then? So with that in mind, this sort of leads us to the question, is the lambda CDM model sufficient in describing our universe? Okay, to that end, I started working on what I call a tomographic coupled dark energy model. So we published a paper on this earlier this year. So if you're interested, please do go check it out. Okay, so first I'd like to introduce this model, which we call coupled dark energy. And as I was saying, it's essentially a class of lambda CDM model extensions. And it was first hypothesized in the 1990s as a solution to another totally different problem termed the coincidence problem. And since then, it has been extensively studied in literature, both at the background and perturbation levels, and N-body simulations have been developed as well as spherical collapse models. And also interestingly, it has been shown to be able to relieve the H-naught tension even before the emergence of said tension. And finally, it's also one of the few model extensions that are still compatible with data today. Hence, it's one of the forerunners when it comes to us considering the viability of various classes of lambda CDM model extensions. Okay, so now let's delve into a bit of the theoretical formalism behind this model. Okay. So firstly, starting from first principles, we have the Lagrangian of the dark spectra written down as such.
Microphone followers.
So starting from the Lagrangian, so here we have L dark, so we write it as the kinetic and potential term of the field phi, as well as the kinetic and potential term of our dark matter particles psi. So what we essentially do is to assume that dark energy takes on the form of a scalar field with a fermionic coupled to fermionic cold dark matter particles with a mass that is dependent on the value of phi. Also, one thing to note is that here we assume that baryons are not coupled to this whole regime, so it satisfies solar system constraints. Okay, so from the Lagrangian, we can then write down the modified energy momentum tensor, T mu nu. So here, as you can see, the T mu nu, instead of it being zero on the right-hand side, as in lambda CDM, here we've introduced a couple of new terms. Okay, so kappa is just your reduced Planck mass. And here the parameter of concern is beta. So beta is written as a differential of partial m over partial phi. So it's a function of the scalar field. And it is essentially what we term as a coupling strength parameter. So basically it governs the strength between which cold dark matter and the scalar field couples to each other. So from this setup, we can see that essentially dark matter particles feel a fifth force that is stronger than gravity. So instead of your regular Newtonian gravitational constant G, there is now a new g effective, which is a factor of g by 1 plus 2 beta squared. And from past literature, we've also seen that beta has been observationally constrained to be on the order of 0.1 or less. Okay, so looking at the background evolution, then we can then write down the background equations for phi and CDM as such, rho CDM. And once again, we see on the right-hand side of these equations, we have the emergence of the beta parameter. And we see that if we solve these equations, the effect of coupling essentially only becomes significant when rho CDM is non-relativistic or non-negligible. So during the meta-dominated era, you would assume that the effects of coupling is the most evident. Okay, then we can also express, as usual in regular coupled quintessence formalism, the density and pressure of the scalar field as such. Here we have the potential of the field. And in our work, for simplicity, we just assume a flat potential. So V phi is just V naught, after which we constrain. And this is responsible for late time acceleration. Okay, then for perturbation evolution, so here we have the, in the synchronous gauge, the evolution for the perturbed scalar field, so phi delta phi. And the equation that's more of interest, however, here is your density contrast of your cold dark matter particle, so your delta CDM. So we can write it as a second order ODE as such. And then we see here, should there be a beta term, essentially what happens is when you solve these equations, clustering is enhanced in a coupled dark energy framework. So the mean two takeaways would be that at the background evolution, you have an energy transfer from your dark matter to your dark energy, so your rho CDM decreases, but then your clustering increases. Okay, so that's all well and good. What I've described earlier has been extensively studied since the 1990s. However, in the past work, what has been assumed is that the coupling constant beta that I've introduced has generally been assumed to take on a constant value. However, we want to ask, does this have to be so? For example, number one, there is no physical motivation behind why coupling should be similarly bounded at all stages of cosmic evolution. And also, secondly, if we look into other paradigms of coupling, such as between vacuum energy and dark matter, as well as between dark matter particles themselves, you see that there has already been literature studying varying coupling paradigms. So we want to try and do that as well. So in this work, the main thrust was to investigate, firstly, what happens if we allow coupling to vary throughout cosmic evolution. Secondly, with that in mind, how will exactly the cosmological parameters be affected by such a tomographic coupling? And also, if the H0 and S8 tensions could be further alleviated by loosening constraints on coupling. Okay, so how do we do this? Firstly, we propose a new parameterization for beta. So now here we express beta as a function of redshift instead. So beta is a function of Z. And we chose a purely phenomenological expression for this. So here we rewrite beta Z as a sum of hyperbolic tangents. Here we have a few new parameters. So firstly, n, which is the number of bins. So we sort of bin the coupling as a function of redshift with the number of bins that we arbitrarily can choose. And bi is basically the strength of coupling within each bin. And zi is the value of the redshift bin edges. And si is just the smoothing factor, which we adopt to be a constant value throughout to ensure differentiability between the bin edges. So on the right here, you see a plot of a toy model reconstruction of beta against a function of redshift. So here we have assumed, for simplicity, three redshift bins at bin edges 100 and 1,000. And we want to constrain the strength of coupling independently within each bin.
What are the bins that you said 100, 1,000, and what else?
Yeah, so 0, 100, and 1,000.
0, 100.
Yeah.
Could I see one more time how the beta enter your action?
The beta. So basically, the action is a function of your Lagrangian, and then here your Lagrangian is basically just a field, like following, like a field coupling to your fermionic particles, and then the coupling comes in your energy momentum tension, essentially. So if you plug it, if you solve for L.
So you'll have, if I want to look at it as an action, you have the dark energy Lagrangian plus whatever matter you have with this beta grad phi coupled to the matter.
Sorry, could you repeat?
So it's beta grad phi coupled to the Lagrangian of the matter sector. Is that what I have to do?
No, you just have to integrate this. It's integral of beta d phi, and that's your M. So if you go to the previous slide,
Sorry, this thing's a bit slow.
Yeah, so that M is just integral of, it's an exponential of integral of beta.
So beta is in that M.
Yeah.
Yes. So in the formalism, yeah, beta is a partial M, partial phi. So intrinsically, beta is a function of your scalar field, and then we sort of re-encapsulate that as beta as a function of Z. So then we assume that your scalar field is varying with redshift. So like by the chain rule, then you can then express beta as a function of Z. Yeah. And then reconstruct the value of M from there.
Okay. So you're saying this beta definition by itself, it doesn't have to be constant, it's a phi dependent.
Yes. Okay, so then going back here. So yeah, as I was saying, we could then choose arbitrarily the value of your bin edges and the number of bins. And from there, what we did was to try and plot out the omega values for your scalar field as well as for your matter. So here, what we did on the left-hand side, you see an evolution of omega scalar field. And in the green dotted line, it's lambda CDM. And then we successively turn on coupling at higher and higher redshifts. So we see that when we do that, going from the green to the orange, blue, and then red, you see a sort of scaling solution being achieved for omega scalar field, during the matter-dominated era. And then this subsequently leads to your omega M sort of decreasing. And this effect is especially evident during the matter domination era as well. And then when you plot a function, yes?
I'm curious if you could walk us through is there a particular motivation for choosing these particular redshift bins? Is it just something to try?
Yeah, this was like a first example, just to try. But then afterwards, when we try and constrain our model, it was motivated by the data that we have, basically.
May I ask, so for this beta to change, phi should grow significantly, right? Because beta depends on phi.
Mm-hmm.
Using constant was assuming some kind of slow roll, I believe.
Yes.
So now you are saying, no, it can change. So that means what? That means phi actually rolls a lot during longer,
If you solve the equations for phi, for example, here I have a function. So you sort of see, where did it go? So you can like plot phi as the scale factor A here, and then phi prime as function of the scale factor A, and you see sort of phi is like slowly increasing. So this is units of the reduced Planck mass, and then for phi prime you see it sort of just goes to zero, and then this leads to this very slow rolling value for your scalar field.
But at late times you have slow roll, right? In the beginning it's pretty fast. That's what you're saying.
Is that A?
Yes, A. So scale factor. So yeah. So here's today.
Okay. So beta changes because of this, right? Because phi changes.
Is it obvious that the beta is pi dot? Axial case, you might imagine that definition, but that's like
it doesn't depend
derivative
on
the mass of the field. That's what beta is.
Yeah. It's logarithmic derivative of the mass, yeah.
So here what we're doing, we're fixing the value of beta, and then we see what happens consequently with phi. So like it's a consequence of the value of beta instead of like you fixing phi and then seeing how beta changes.
Yeah, but eventually that corresponds to some dependence of the CDM mass on phi. What is gonna be? I mean, perhaps it should not be too crazy.
The mass of, you can consider if, let's say, if you follow the equation of what I showed you.
Is there a potential for phi?
It's a flat potential.
So M of phi is also the potential for phi as well. Right. Mm-hmm.
So here in this case, it's just a flat potential. And then you can calculate M based on like the value of phi and then your value for beta, and then from there you reconstruct the evolution of the mass of your cold dark matter.
Can you speak up a bit, sorry?
Sorry? I was just saying that you fix your value for beta, and then from there you calculate your evolution for phi, and then you can reconstruct the evolution of your MCDM as a function of phi. But then, it's an exponential. For that. Yep. So then here we have a plot of your Hubble function against redshift. So we see that what happens here is we kept initial conditions constant, and then we let the code run, and then you see that at the current time, which is z plus 1 equals to 1, this sort of lowers your H naught, the value of your Hubble constant, because your rho CDM decreases as you switch on coupling at progressively earlier times. Sorry, this is not showing up. Okay, then moving on to your perturbation. So first on the left, we have a plot of your matter power spectrum. And on your right, your CMB temperature and isotropies. And then what we did here was to see the effect of coupling within each respective tomographic bin. So we kept B2, beta3 equals to 0, and just switch on coupling at late times. And we see that this affects your amplitude of clustering at all scales. So going from beta1 equals 0.05 to 0.25, this increases the amplitude of your PKs. And also, on the right, you have your CMB temperature and isotropy peaks that will get shifted to higher multiples due to your decrease in the Hubble function. And then we did this for...
besides this like shift in the location, should mm-hmm. there also be some kind of ISW effect, due to omega matter changing?
Yes. I have a plot here. So for example, here we compared, because it's a skipped slide, sorry. So here we compared between a couple dark energy and lambda CDM in orange and in blue. So you sort of get an increase in your ISW. This is just a toy example of turning on coupling at all redshifts. So then this will affect both your early time ISW as well as your late time integrated. Yeah. Yes. This does affect as well.
Yeah, can you show the power spectrum changes? Yeah, once you get also ISW at intermediate scales because of accelerated growth of structure, basically.
Intermediate scales, you mean?
Well, at L, between, up. Below the first peak, basically.
Yes. So, like, I was showing. So here is like L equals to 10 and then 20.
What I would expect, because you have like matter growth, which is kind of detuned from, it reaches faster than the normal CDM.
Your matter over densities grow. Yes.
Yeah, and kind of faster than mm-hmm. normal CDM. So mm-hmm. that. Uses ISW at this range.
Any constraint in CMB? spectrum?
Yeah, if it grew kind of faster than it should, faster than 1 over a, then Newtonian potential doesn't stay constant, it also grows.
Right.
So then it produces
like a curvature-like effect.
Hmm?
It's boosted on ultra-large scales. By the time you arrive at 20, you're...
No, it gives well, everywhere, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would assume that it would give a boost at smaller scales, because if you're considering late time ISW.
What is the beta that you use here?
Here it was 0.01, so maybe that's why it's too small to see.
Was it, you had to square it, or was it just beta that was the change?
It's just beta.
Just beta, okay. Yeah. So it's 1%. Maybe it's not big enough to see.
Just don't see it.
Yeah, maybe. It's a marginal effect on the ISW. I would say the larger effect would be the shift in your multiples, as well as if we turn on coupling at early time, so pre-recombination era. Oops. You see a sort of boost in the first amplitude of the first peak, because then there you are changing your rho CDM, and then this changes the ratio between rho CDM, rho B, and then this leads to. So these effects, I would say, are the larger effect than your ISW. Yeah. Okay, so we move on, and then now we talk a bit about like the methodology behind how I go around constraining this model. So what we did was to modify the Boltzmann solver class to basically change the equations of motion to mimic our model here, and then run MCMC, and then we perform a likelihood analysis to constrain our model. And we use three different parameterizations for beta, of which I will the motivation of which I will explain later a bit more. So firstly, the three-bin model that I described earlier on, where you have your bin edges 0, 100, and 1,000. And then here, we only used high redshift probes, which is essentially CMB, to constrain this parameterization. And then next, we added low redshift data, so BAO, type 1A supernova, your RSD, and SHUS. And here, since we have more data at low redshifts, then we include like a finer binning at low redshift, so 0, 1, 2, 5 as well. And then finally, we used purely weak lensing, galaxy clustering, and 3x2-point data. And in this case, we just bin it at low redshift, so with bin edges 0, 0.5, 1, and 2, since we don't have any more data beyond that. And so here are our results. So firstly, with CMB constraints, reminding you these were the bin edges corresponding to structure formation, post-recombination, and pre-recombination errors. And then specifically, what CMB data we used, firstly. So Planck 2018 full power spectrum, as well as data from the ACT DR4 and the SBT3G as well. And these two data sets were new data sets that have never been used in to constrain such a CDE framework. And they also were in a bit of tension with Planck, so we want to see what happens if we want to combine or sort of exclusively complement Planck data. So the cuts we used, firstly, we have four different CMB scale cuts. Firstly, the full Planck power spectrum, TT, TE, and EE, from the full range of multiples. And then secondly, we added ACT data, but then we performed a cut at L minimum of 1,800. And this was just purely to avoid double counting. And then thirdly, we added on SBT data. And then finally, we considered a cut on the Planck data instead. So as opposed to number three, number four is more reliant on ACT and SBT. So here we introduced an LMAX of 650 for your Planck TT spectrum. And this particular data set, now number four, has shown to lend preference towards EDE models, so early dark energy models. So we want to see if that's the case for a couple dark energy model as well. Okay, so here are some results. So here I have a reconstruction of beta z at 2 sigma upper bound. So for the different data sets are in different colors, and we compare it with a constant case that we got.
Question. So this cannot go negative?
It can in principle, yeah, but here we just considered a positive beta. Like we set a hard prior beta greater than 0.
Is there any reason for that? I just...
No, it was just for simplicity.
It could be this negative, but...
Yeah, yeah, it could be. So that's like an extended work as well.
Okay.
Yes.
You'd probably expect it to collapse in like...
I don't
know.
This would change your evolution of your row CDM. And then it also depends on whether it's always positive, always negative. If it's always negative, then it's the same, because in your equations, it's beta squared that's coming out. But if it changes...
There is a reason that you expect the fifth force to be attractive, not repulsive. Is there? Maybe that's the reason you want it to be positive.
Mm.
No, it's also
going
to
be
beta square. The fifth force will be beta square.
Is it beta? I thought it was beta.
Yeah, so for example here, we... Where was it?
Oh, I see.
So it's beta can change in time, as we were saying in our paper. Then this would slow down the evolution of delta CDM. So this comes in especially in your perturbation equations. So this would affect your friction term basically, because here it's beta and not beta squared.
That's right. Mm-hmm. I guess the beta squared is 2 beta squared.
Yeah.
Beta squared is just 1.
I see.
Yeah. But yeah, indeed, we can consider like a negative beta as well. That would be interesting to see. So then, generally, if you can...
Yeah, turn the discussion of positive negative. So now energy goes from dark energy to dark matter, or other way around?
The other way around, dark matter to dark energy.
Okay, that's for positive. We change sign, it will be from dark energy to dark
matter. Yes, because it depends on beta phi prime. So, yeah, in that sense. Yeah, beta and phi prime both positive. Yeah. Okay, so, yeah, then if you consider the colored lines versus the black lines, you see that tromographic coupling allows for larger values of beta than constant coupling, so it's less restrictive across all data sets.
So there must then be also like perturbations in the phi field itself, right?
Yes, perturbations in the phi field, yeah.
And this phi field you said is like dark energy also?
Yeah, we treat it like analogous to dark energy. Yeah.
And so in your class calculations then you self-consistently also then account for the perturbations of the dark energy?
Yes. But then I would assume the data that you have probe more the perturbations of your cold dark matter, because that's like evident in your metapower spectrum, and then that's the data that we have. So perturbations in your scalar field, I'm not sure if you have any data to probe that.
Sure, but those perturbations affect the growth of the matter perturbations, right?
Yes, sure. But then I would think the effect on your matter perturbations would be larger than the perturbations of your scalar field.
I'm just asking if it's self-consistently computed.
Yeah, it is. But yeah, in the code it is, yes. So yeah, and then we see that it's still consistent with some CDM. Your beta equals to 0 is not rolled out at 95% confidence level. So the black line at the bottom, it's just beta equals to 0 is still consistent. Okay, now looking at constraints on coupling at pre-recombination. So first we get the tightest constraints from our Planck dataset. And interestingly, what happens is when we add on data, this loosens constraints. So here, firstly, we see progressively if you add on ACT data, this increases your upper bound of beta 3. And then even more when you add SBT data. And finally, in the green dataset, when you cut out your low multiples of Planck, this leads to the loosest bounds on beta 3. And then, so essentially what we get is that basically Planck still gives the tightest constraints on coupling at pre-recombination eras, since the data of Planck fixes the amplitude of your first peak to higher precision. So this is kind of what we expected, even though it was interesting to note that like when you add data, it increases your bounds. But then again, your ACT and SPT is a bit in tension, so that was how we thought it could lead to this loosening of constraints. Okay, then next, moving on, we have here your mean and one sigma of your various cosmological parameters for all the data sets that we tested. It's a very busy plot, but what we see that firstly, it's consistent with Planck fiducial lambda CDM within one sigma. So Planck fiducial is the pink band here we have. So the gray dotted lines, the vertical gray dotted lines and pink bands. And then if we compare the dark blue horizontal ones with the pink bands, you sort of see that they're still within one sigma. However, interestingly, clustering is increased as expected. And then secondly, also if we focus on H-naught, the value of H-naught is increased by roughly one sigma.
Could you say again why the clustering increase is expected?
Because from your perturbation equations, you get like increase in beta, so increase in coupling, then this sort of increases your the evolution of your delta CDM, and then your S8 would increase in that sense. Okay, and then with regards to alleviating the H-naught tension, we can then look at, so in lambda CDM, you sort of have a 4.8 sigma tension that we all know if we compare between the value derived from Planck and Schuss. However, if we look at a constant coupling case, this reduces to 2.9 sigma and slightly more in a tomographic case to 2.7 sigma. However, one thing to note is that this increase is largely generated by your increase in the error bars. So here in lambda CDM, the Planck error bars is like 0.6. for one sigma, but then in a constant coupling case, this sort of doubles, and the mean only shifts by about one sigma value. Okay, then moving on, let's see what more like background constraints can tell us. So reminding you again, this is a slightly finer binning, where we add background data at low redshifts, largely.
So you didn't tell us the best fit values for these betas, did you, or?
Yeah, we'll report just the upper limits and not the.
That's the best fit values.
Since it's a prior, like we set a hard prior at zero, so we just sort of give a upper bound on beta.
I'm imagining what's happening is that there's a preference for a positive beta 3 and there's a best fit, which is you kind of starting to exclude zero some confidence. That's the only way that you can get worse constraint if you add data.
When we use CMB, we see that all still, the lower bound is all still consistent with zero. Yeah.
It's in the previous slide before this one. Oh, not ruled out, okay.
They're not ruled out. For none of them, it's ruled out.
But then this is a, to tease this slightly different in the case when you add background data. So as we shall see. Okay, so we employ data sets from firstly BAO, type 1A supernovae, and then cosmic chronometers, your redshift space distortions, as well as a Schuss prior. So what we did was to try and add these data sets in a very directed way, instead of just blindly combining all of them. And then what we did was to add them individually to our baseline CMB data to understand their individual effect on coupling constraints. So more specifically,
what are the red ones?
So the red ones here are just new data sets that we updated. So these weren't used before in to constrain coupling, couple dark energy, yeah, in previous literature. Okay, so then. So specifically what data sets we use, so we consider like a base CMB data set, Planck, ACT, and SPT, and then we add on data. So firstly, here we have BAO, SNE1A, and your cosmic chronometers, which we term BSC.
What are cosmic chronometers?
They're basically measurements of the Hubble function that is like separate from Pantheon. Like what they did was to measure slow, passively evolving galaxies. So it's a model independent way of measuring your Hubble function. Yes. And then we add on RST, and then we change it to what, see what happens if we instead use a Schuss prior. And then finally, what happens if we combine them? And then also we changed up the CMB data set. Instead of using Planck plus ACT 1800, we used a more ACT SPT heavy data set and excluded the first multiple Planck to see how that changes constraints. So we want to see what each background data set can tell us about coupling at different redshifts. Okay, so here are some results. So here, once again, we show the two sigma constraints on the different beta, so beta 1 to 7, since we have 7 bins. And then we see that generally across the board, coupling is least constrained at late times, so at z less than 5, and most constrained during your structure formation era. So if we zoom in here, for example, with this particular Planck ACT 1800 SPT and BSC data, we see that at low redshifts, you can get very high values of coupling and even favoring for non-null values of coupling. Versus if we look at during structure formation era between 100 to 500 redshift, you get very tight constraints on what the upper bound of coupling can be. And also if we compare between CMB data sets, you see that a non-null coupling seems to be generally favored when you have a Planck heavy CMB based data set. And we think that this might be due to the fact that you need to have non-null values of beta to reconcile the tension between the H0 value, for example, when you have combined both Planck and Schuss data. Okay, finally, we move on to weak lensing constraints. So in this case, it's the first time that we use weak lensing, galaxy clustering, and 3x2-point to constrain a CDE model. So we do this for both a constant and 4-bit tomographic case, where we only bin it at low redshifts. And what we did was to use data, firstly, cosmic shear data in the form of the angular path spectrum CLs from your KIDS 1000 survey. And then secondly, we use your spectroscopic galaxy clustering correlation function from BOSDR12. And then we cross-correlated them to get your 3x2-point data set. So cosmic shear, galaxy-galaxy lensing, and galaxy clustering. Also, one thing to note is that we applied a very conservative cut at high multiples to exclude your nonlinear scales, since we don't really have a very good prescription for the nonlinear scales of the matter power spectrum in the case of a tomographic CDE model. So we don't want to bias the results we get in the end. Okay, so here we have some results in the case of the betas, once again, reconstruction of beta as a function of z for all the different data sets considered. So here we look at just the green values. So in solid green lines, you have your tomographic coupled dark energy model with cosmic shear. Dotted green, it's cosmic shear in a constant case. And then we also added CMB-based data to see if that increases your constraining power, and it does. However, one interesting thing to note is that if we compare between colors, so cosmic shear versus galaxy clustering and 3x2-point in blue and red, we see that with cosmic shear, we don't get a lot of constraining power as compared to spectroscopic galaxy clustering. And also, we see that it's not very sensitive towards the changes in the different tomographic bins. So we get roughly the same constraints going across bins from 0, 0.5, 1, and 2. Finally, one interesting result that we got is that we see that constraining power of your 3x2-point is actually almost stronger than Planck. And this is a very good cross-check because we know that Planck and 3x2-point, they basically probe very different eras in your cosmic evolution and have very different independent systematics.
Sorry, question. What are you assuming for what happens beyond redshift of 3?
We just assume that beyond 2, it's constant. We can't constrain it, basically. Yeah. Okay, then in terms of alleviating tensions, once again, here we have a plot of this mean and 1 sigma of all the different results for all the different data sets and constant and for the constant and tomographic case. And if we zoom in for the results we get on S8. So firstly, in the lambda CDM regime, you have a 3.1 sigma discrepancy between the results reported by Planck and kids for the 3x2-point data set. However, if we look at a constant coupling regime, this sort of reduces to 1.8 sigma if we compare between the red horizontal line and the blue horizontal line, the light blue horizontal line that we get. So in this case, coupling is able to alleviate tension to some extent. Okay, so finally, we conducted a bit of model comparison, as is usually the case in such when you introduce a new model, when you you do Bayesian inference. So firstly, what we did was to calculate your delta chi-square minimum. And we see that they are all negative values for all the different parameterizations that we have. And this shows that your coupled dark energy model is basically a better fit to the data than lambda CDM. However, we argue that this is just a rough estimate. It's not very rigorous. So then we took it a step further to calculate the Bayes ratio, which gives a more accurate measure of the goodness of fit, since it takes into account the number of parameters in your proposed model. So then we did that by doing calculating the evidence, so E here in your ln E. And we see that they are all, the value of ln B in all cases is less than minus 3, which according to the Jeffrey scale, this indicates substantial preference for lambda CDM. Since in the case, for example, of a 7-bin model, you're introducing twice as many parameters. So this greatly penalizes the model. Okay.
So this was for which data set?
This is for the baseline Planck ACT SVT VSC data.
I see.
And interestingly also, when you use cosmic shear, you get a very negative value for your Bayes ratio as well. Okay, so conclusions here. So what we did was essentially to study a class of lambda CDM model extensions called the coupled dark energy model, where we assume that dark energy takes on the form of a scalar field, mediating interactions between your dark matter particles with a coupling strength parameter beta. And then we introduce a new tomographic parameterization for beta by allowing it to vary with redshift. And here we study three different parameterizations where we bin it and redshifts and try to independently constrain it within each redshift bin. So firstly, we have a 3-bin model probed by CMB, and then a 7-bin model where we add on low redshift probes, and finally a 4-bin and constant model probed by weak lensing, galaxy clustering, and galaxy-galaxy lensing for the first time. So in the case of a 3-bin model, we see that constraints are looser compared to a constant coupling case, also because you're introducing more degrees of freedom, and that your H-naught tension is reduced from 4.8 sigma to 2.9 and 2.7 sigma. And then in a 7-bin case, we see that this tells us a lot about the dynamics of the different structure formation era, for example, where we get the tightest constraints on coupling and the loosest constraints at late times. So we see that instead of just naively putting a blanket constant coupling value, it can actually change a lot. It's the data that we have is very sensitive towards the changes in what beta can be. And finally, with weak lensing galaxy clustering and 3x2-point, we see that in particular, GC and 3x2-point can strongly constrain coupling at low redshifts. It's even comparable to your CMB. So hence, in light of upcoming stage 4 surveys like Euclid, LSST, DESI, these probes actually exhibit great potential in constraining such lambda CDM model extensions. And I'm just going to quickly go over the second part because I think we're out of time. So here, I'll talk a bit about the second part of the work that I did. So this is slightly related to a tomographic coupled dark energy model. Here, we term it an early coupled quintessence. And this work was done in collaboration with colleagues from Lisbon under the Campus France Partnership Grant. So this is the paper that we have. And in this model, this model was largely studied by Joan and Javier in Lisbon, which determined the early coupled quintessence model. So it's a subset of your tomographic CDE where coupling only exists at high redshifts, specifically during your radiation-dominated era. So this was this such a model was only studied from a phenomenological point of view up till now, and it has been proposed for its interesting implications. Firstly, during radiation dominated era, the growth of your DM perturbation over densities is enhanced with the presence of such a coupling, and then it quickly becomes nonlinear, leading to virialization, and then you can have objects forming such as your primordial dark matter halos, primordial black holes, which they argue can be candidates for dark matter. So what happens exactly at coupling at a RDE? So firstly, recalling your background equations, so it's exactly the same as before, but in during RDE, there is no observational constraint on how large beta can be. So for example, if you have large enough values of beta larger than 1, you admit like an attractor solution. Yeah. So here, for example, what you get is that during RDE, your rho phi and rho CDM sort of track the evolution of rho r, and it's only purely a function of your coupling beta. So to be more precise, here we have a plot of your various omega i's as a function of redshift. And then what we see here is that in the blue part of the plot here is your when coupling is present, and then the dotted line is the redshift at which it is turned off, so z off. And then you see a sort of scaling regime that's achieved when you focus on the green and red lines, so that's your dm and de. So these sort of track your radiation in purple. So your solid lines are in an ECQ model versus your dotted lines in lambda CDM. So here we assume coupling is activated from some initial time, which we set as 10 to the 16 for just for the numerical reasons in the code. And then what we see is that we can sort of match your omega i's just before and after coupling at z off. And then you get a theoretical relation between z off and beta square. So if you put in your current values of omega CDM naught and omega r naught, you sort of get like a 10 to the 4 relation between z off and beta square. And so this is a plot of what happens if you follow along this degeneracy line. So you set beta to be here 3, 10, 20, 30, and then correspondingly you calculate z off and you plot your evolution of omega dm, particularly and your omega de. You see a sort of they end up at the same place on so the left, the y-axis is the current time, so they sort of end up at the same current conditions, but your initial conditions change, and then the distance between your omega r here and omega dm, the distance between that is just dependent on the value of beta square. Okay, so interestingly, another thing to note is when you look at the perturbation evolution equations. So once again, you can solve for your delta CDM here in your second order ODE. And then what you get is that you see that it scales as a function of your scale factor A with gradient P, which is like the Gordon ratio. So it scales as a power law with a Gordon ratio gradient. And then we can plot this out as well. So at small enough scale, so here's just a toy model example considering super small scales of like k equals to 45, just for illustration purposes. What we see is that when we plot delta dm against your scale factor, so on the right on the left, the mode hasn't entered yet, so it evolves as lambda CDM. But then once the mode enters your horizon, you get like a alpha to the power of your golden ratio growth. And then once coupling is turned off, it sort of goes to a ln A growth as compared to lambda CDM in yellow, which is much slower growth. So they argue that in such a case, you can this can lead to virialization and forming of a compact primordial artifact.
So sorry, what does at late times delta dark matter goes as ln A in this model?
Yeah, so in this case, it decays at ln A, but then, and then beyond it, at larger scales, it kind of goes with A again. So it's like it's just a numerical artifact of the code where it needs time to sort of go
Okay.
Yeah, go up again. So you see, to catch up, basically. Yeah.
Catch up to what? Sorry, I didn't follow.
To your delta DMA evolution. It's not really shown here because it's a numerical artifact of the code, where first you sort of go a to the phi, and then it sort of decays to ln a and then goes again to a.
But there are two modes, like there's a growing mode and a decaying mode, or is that, I forgot there's a, because there's a second order equation, and the growing mode is a, but then if you have this phase transition, you have both the decaying and growing mode. So it takes time to have growing mode to take over. I'm guessing that's why.
Yes.
A factor of like 1,000 in a, really?
Yeah.
It was a thing with the code, because you see when you have mode entry, it doesn't immediately grow as a to the phi. It still goes a bit on the left of the mode reentry line. You see it still goes a to the square, and then it takes a bit of time to evolve as a to the phi. So then there's like a calculation, it's like a numerical calculation of the code of class that
Yeah, but the puzzle I think, you know, is about like the late time evolution of the blue curve. Why is it growing so slowly instead of growing like, you know, the normal delta goes like a.
Yeah, we think it's a problem with the code, because this was calculated with the code, and then there was like this issue of, yeah, why is it that it was starting so late as compared to theoretical calculations of when your mode reentry should be, and then when you're coupling off, and then when it should go up. But then we see that there's this, it takes some time to evolve as expected. So you see at the end here, you have like a at the end here, then it starts to catch up to like an A growth.
Yeah.
We can talk more about this after. Okay, so quickly, just methodology. So once again, we employ the same technique that we use to run MCMC to obtain observational constraints on such a model, for which was the first time that this was done. So we want to see if, even with the data that we have, whether we can somehow try and constrain such a early coupled quintessence model. So then we use CMB, BOSS DR12 data, so background constraints, as well as Pantheon plus type 1a supernova constraints data. And also we fixed prior ranges for beta and Zetov. And what we did was to, because of your BBN constraints on what values of omega B and omega R can take during your radiation dominated era, here you have like hard lower bounds on beta, which is non-zero. So it's a 3 to 30. So this is kind of like not a nested, you can't recover lambda CDM here. So it's not a nested model in this sense. And then Zetov is essentially the priors were calculated based on beta. And here are the results that we have. So here's the full contour plot comparing ECQ in green and then lambda CDM in red. And we see that generally results are consistent with lambda CDM, comparing between the colored contours. And also one thing to note is that here there is no effect on what the H-naught tension, since coupling is only activated at very high redshifts. That can't affect your Hubble function at redshifts anything less than 10 to the 5, for example. And if we zoom in on the posteriors that we get for beta square and zeta off, we see that firstly, they are largely prior dominated, which is somewhat expected since we don't have data sets that can give constraints at such high redshifts of 10 to the 5. However, if we zoom in on the plane of zeta off and beta squared, we see that we are able to obtain this very tight degeneracy that we earlier derived only theoretically. So if we calculate this ratio, it's about 11.8 to the power minus 5, which then, if you, as I've shown earlier, Z off over beta squared currently is about 10 to the 4. So then we are able to recover this degeneracy between beta squared and Z off. Okay, so one thing that we did was to try and see whether we can then break this degeneracy. So then we plot out the PKs and your CMBs for varying values of beta and Z off along the degeneracy line. And you see that you only start being able to break this degeneracy at very nonlinear scales. So for example, for beta 3 in blue, you see this only happens, like a deviation from lambda CDM PKs only happens at like k equals to 1. But, and your CMB is essentially, your CMB temperature is essentially the same. And also we then calculated the base factor once again, and it's minus 3.19, showing substantial evidence for lambda CDM. So second part of the conclusions. Firstly, we studied a class of tomographic CDE models, subset of it called, which we call the early coupled quintessence model, where coupling is only present during your radiation domination era. And secondly, what we did was to see that if beta is sufficiently large, we are able to get a sort of scaling solution with your background evolution equations. Also, thirdly, perturbation growth is much stronger than in the lambda CDM framework, which is interesting, which leads to interesting growth of primordial artifacts like black holes and dark matter halos. And then what we did was for the first time to sort of perform a Bayesian inference on such an ECQ model and try and constrain it with observational data. And we see that we are able to recover this Z off beta squared degeneracy. And so what we want to do is to be able to then get like a theoretical prescription for your nonlinear metapath spectrum in order to break this degeneracy and see if we can then differentiate between different classes of beta and Z off. Okay, so in light of all that I've presented, so here are some future work that I'm considering. So firstly, as I was saying, to try and develop a model for the nonlinear prescription of PK in a tomographic CDE case, for example, using fitting functions or emulators. And also then with that, we can utilize your full constraining power of cosmic shear and other probes like your Lyman alpha forest and your CMB spectral distortions, for example. And then we've seen how galaxy clustering and your 3x2 point give very tight constraints on coupling. So what we aim to do is try and derive constraints using upcoming data from stage 4 surveys like Euclid. And to that end, I'm currently working in Euclid, as Niyash was talking about before, where I specifically contribute towards the likelihood code CLOE, and we're hoping to be able to incorporate lambda CDM model extensions in the pipeline as well. And with that, thank you very much. And if you have any questions, just hit me up.
Wonderful. And then just before taking questions, so Lisa is going to be here through the end of today and tomorrow as well. So if you want to be here, she does have a schedule.
Preferably today, if possible.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tomorrow then. And 366 is your.
Yes, 366.
Questions?
Yeah, I'm curious in terms of the constraints from the 3x2 and galaxy clustering and all
mm-hmm.
the sort of low redshift probes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if you have a sense, because you looked at lots of different data combinations, I just didn't quite catch it. Like how much constraining power gets added by looking at like the full shape of galaxy clustering or structure growth as opposed to like picking out the BAO features? I'm kind of
right.
trying to think through like how much of the constraining power is from how this impacts expansion history as opposed to like perturbation growth.
Right. So we think that one reason why we get so tight constraints with GC is also because it's spectroscopic GC as opposed to just photometric galaxy clustering. So we didn't add it to BAO because that will be double counting. But
it has some BAO information.
Yeah, so with your BOS full shape galaxy clustering, yeah, there is the BAO features in there. And yeah, one thing we could do, for example, is to just use BAO and then use that same parameterization, Forbin parameterization, to see if that changes constraints on beta as well.
Did you look at, because you looked at RSD for the fewer bin case, right?
Yes.
Did you look at all of like BA only versus BAO plus RSD?
Yes, we did. For example, here if we compare between the light blue ones and the brown ones, for example, playing at 1800 SPT BSC RC, so you get very tight constraints with RSD, as opposed to if you just use BAO, supernova, and cosmic chronometers. Yeah.
Thank you.
No problem.
Other questions? If not, then we can close the lunch now. Thank you.
Thank you.